the rate, the homes that they enter. Can we find out what happened in these homes? We have no idea of holding. I think the Israeli court has also tried to get some information from the military, but so far very few cases have been resolved. And we're talking about mass, not only 500 or 600 people, we're talking about tens of thousands who have been separated, their homes raided during what is now 15 months of war in Gaza.
Sara El-Deeb, we want to thank you for being with us. Associated Press investigative reporter based in the Middle East for two decades, now reporting from Damascus. Next up, today is the 75th day of a hunger strike by Leila Swaif. She is the mother of prominent British-Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah. She's calling on British officials to pressure Egypt for the release of her son. We'll speak to the Cairo University mathematics professor in London, where she's been standing outside the Foreign Office. Back in 20 seconds.
With the conviction of the woman you made me, I find blades of grass from the island you lent me. I find on every floor in every drawer though I'm not an island, I'm a body of water.
Solitary Daughter by Bedouin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 75 days ago, Leila Swaif, the British-Egyptian mother of the prominent British-Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah, stopped eating. Leila Swaif is a mathematics professor at Cairo University. She began her hunger strike as part of a campaign demanding the British government pressure Egypt for the release of her son, Ala, he was due to be released from prison September 29th after 5 years behind bars over unfounded charges of spreading false news. He was rearrested in 2019, just 6 months after he was conditionally released from prison, where he served another lengthy sentence over his activism in Egypt's 2011 uprising. Egyptian authorities have refused to count more than 2 years Ala spent in pretrial detention toward time served, meaning Ala now won't be released until 2027. Ala has spent most of the last decade behind bars, separated from his family. His agonizing and seemingly indefinite imprisonment is part of a wider crackdown on human rights, press freedom and dissent by the regime of the Egyptian president Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Leila Swaif has stepped up her peaceful action, now vowing to stand outside the British Foreign Office in London for at least an hour a day until Ala is free. She receives an update on his condition or until she collapses. She'll join us in a minute. First, this is Ala Abdel Fattah, speaking in his own words when Democracy Now! First interviewed him in February 2011 during our special coverage of the Egyptian uprising. And I've just been told that we do have someone on the phone right now, so we're going to go right to that person. Can you tell us who you are and where you are?
This is Ala Abdel Fattah. I'm an activist in this revolution. I'm standing in front of the TV building in Cairo.
Tell us, Ala. It's great to have you with us, a prominent Egyptian blogger, democracy activist. What is happening in front of the presidential palace, one of a number of new places that are being occupied by protesters like Egyptian state TV as well and the parliament?
In front of the TV building, it's a big crowd. We can't shut down the TV building because of its shape, and it's heavily barricaded by the army. But what we're trying to do is put pressure on the employees working inside to join us, to revolt and refuse to spread state propaganda.
Alaa Abdel Fattah has faced horrific conditions in prison. At the Toura prison complex in 2019, Egyptian police subjected him to beatings and torture. He's since been transferred, but Amnesty International found prison authorities have denied him access to fresh air and sunlight for the past 5 years and continue to deny him access to his lawyer and consular visits with British officials. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by Leila Swaif. She is Alaa's mother. She's 68 years old. Today is the 75th day of her hunger strike. Professor, thanks so much for being with us. Leila Swaif, we spent time in your home after the UN climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh two years ago, where you were demanding your son's freedom. He became a main theme as a political prisoner of the UN climate summit in Egypt. But here you are in Britain as a British Egyptian citizen. Tell us what you are demanding and tell us how you are feeling right now. 75 days without food?
Hello. Before I speak about me and Alaa, I want to say something inspired by what I heard on your program just before I came on about Syrians who had disappeared and Palestinians who had disappeared. In Egypt, too, we have enforced disappearances. Nothing, of course, on the same scale as Syria, but certainly hundreds, maybe even a lot more. Enforced disappearances are becoming more and more something that Egypt, that dictators around our area at least use as a way of intimidating people and families. This has to stop. This has to be taken seriously by already Western powers turn a blind eye on most of the human rights abuses that their allied regimes practice. Can they at least not turn a blind eye on enforced disappearances? Thank you. Now, to get back to Alaa and me and how I'm feeling. First, let me correct you, I'm 68. And yes, I have been 75 days on hunger strike. At the moment, I'm still not feeling any serious consequences of my hunger strike. Mainly, I suppose, because I'm still in the period where the body, particularly if you're taking salts with water, the body burns excess fats. It would seem that we have not gone into the phase where the body starts burning muscle and you start having serious consequences. I have been on, I'm hoping that my hunger strike will create a crisis for both governments, actually. I'm pressuring both governments. I'm binational, so, and Alaa is binational, so I consider that both governments are responsible for him, particularly since they're friendly and allied governments. I'm hoping, since neither government appears to do anything about political prisoners except when there is a crisis, I'm hoping to create a crisis. I'm hoping I've already created a crisis. That's what I'm doing, and that's how I'm feeling.
Leila, in late November, the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, shared photos on social media of his meeting with you. He wrote, quote, "Today I met with Alaa Abdel Fattah's family. They've campaigned tirelessly for his release. I'm focused on securing consular access and his release as quickly as possible. The UK will continue to raise this with the highest levels of the Egyptian government." And this is a clip of the British foreign minister recently addressing the parliament.
"It's of huge concern, and I pressed him to do more. We have continued to do that with the Egyptians. It's obviously sensitive because of the situation in Gaza, but I don't think they're under any doubt how seriously this is taken by the British system, the government, and this parliament."
So that's the British Foreign Minister, David Lammy. Can you explain what kind of pressure Britain can exert on Egypt to release Allah? Are there negotiations taking place? He has said London's relationship with Cairo is important, as he has faced questions about possible economic threats and efforts to free Allah. Also, the British government has repeatedly raised his name at the highest levels, but that clearly hasn't been enough. Is it true you learned that British Prime Minister Keir Starmer did not raise Allah's case when he met with the Egyptian President Sisi on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Brazil? And explain exactly what the terms are that you are demanding right now.
Right. Let's begin with the last question first. No, Mr. Keir Starmer did not raise Allah's case during the G20 summit. That's finally been answered. I mean, an MP demanded tabled the question about that more than 10 days ago, and he finally got the answer like 2 days ago or something, or 3 days ago. So that's the Mr. Keir Starmer did raise the question in August in a phone call with Mr. Sisi, but the difference between August and after 29 September is that on 29 September, Allah finished his sentence. He had been sentenced to 5 years. However unfair that sentence was, however tainted that sentence was, and he was not released. So this should have put matters on a completely different level. That's to your last question. To go back to Mr. Lamy, yes, it is true that he met with us. It is true that he has been making the presentations. It is true, but our experience is that the previous government has been making representations to the higher Egyptian authorities for years. And my take on this is that when you make representations to the highest authorities and nothing happens, then the message getting through is this is to me and to the Egyptian authorities is that this is just lip service, that they don't really have to do anything about it. If you make representations to the highest authorities and nothing happens, you have to do something else afterwards. You can't keep making representations to the highest authorities and then not doing anything about it. What Britain can do, well, Mr. David Lammy, when he was shadow minister, did outline in Parliament what Britain could do. I suggest, again, as I have suggested before, and as I suggested to him during our meeting, that he should go back to his own words when he was shadow minister and try and put some of these measures through.
I want to go back to your son, to Alaa Abd El Fattah, in his own words. We spoke to him in Cairo a decade ago in 2014 when he'd been released on bail after nearly 4 months in prison.
Yeah, I mean, there's been activists in Alexandria have been sentenced for 5 years, I think. No, 2 years. 2 years. And the verdict was confirmed in the appeals process. There's been several groups, student groups, there have been several that have been sentenced anything from 1 year to five. These have been common. There's also a couple of cases where students have been sentenced with crazy, like 14 years and 17 years and 11 years and so on. So they are on a sentencing frenzy. I mean, this is not just about me. And it's almost as if it's a war on a whole generation.
Alaa Abd El Fattah, in 2014, interviewed by our own Sharif Abdelkaddous, who was in Cairo at the time. Leila, your final words to the planet, and also if by any chance Allah can hear you.
I want to see Alaa reunited with his son in Brighton. Khaled is autistic. He's finally settled in a very good special needs school in Brighton. Khaled is 13 this year. Alaa has missed all of his childhood. They need to be together. And until that happens, I am not going to go back on my word. I'm on hunger strike until either I collapse or that happens. I know that this is hard on all my children, particularly Alaa, but they have a life to lead after this, and I hope I'll be there for that life. I don't particularly want to leave them with the memory of a martyred mother. But if that's what it takes, I want Alaa reunited with Khaled in Brighton. And these are my words also to the British and the Egyptian authorities. If you want, a sort of shadow haunting all your relations, right, go on as you're doing now. The Egyptians being stubborn and the British being hesitant, and that's what you'll get. Thank you.
Ellis Wave, thank you so much for joining us. Mother of the jailed Egyptian-British author, activist, blogger Alaa Abdel Fattah. She is on the 75th day of a hunger strike, a fast, calling for the UK government to push for Alaa's release. He's been imprisoned in Egypt despite having completed his sentence in September. Leila Swaif is a mathematics professor at Cairo University. Stay with us. By Can singer Damo Suzuki passed away in February. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at another potential political prisoner, this time here in the United States. Amale Yeshitela, the longtime chair of the African People's Socialist Party, leader of the Uhuru movement. In September, a federal jury in Florida found him and three others guilty of conspiring with an agent of the Russian government to, quote, sow discord and interfere in U.S. elections. But the jury acquitted the four on the most serious charge of acting as agents of a foreign government. Prosecutors had accused them of working on behalf of Russia in a multi-year foreign malign influence campaign here. Amale Yeshitela and his co-defendants, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, have become known as the Uhuru Three. They'll be sentenced next Monday, face up to 5 years in prison. A fourth person, Ghazi Kodzo of the Black Hammer Party, has already been sentenced to 5 years probation. Yeshitela's lawyers had argued the government was targeting the African People's Socialist Party over its longtime criticism of U.S. policy at home and abroad. Amale Yeshitela is 83 years old. He joined me this week from Tampa ahead of Monday's sentencing. I asked him his response to the verdict and what he was charged with and acquitted of.
We were charged, as you mentioned earlier, with being Russian agents and something that they determined, that is, the United States government, that began in 2014, or on or about 2014, and extended up until July 29, 2022, according to them. So after 50 years or so of more, 60 years in my instance of working for the liberation of African people, the U.S. government determined that that since 2014, I became an employee, an agent, under the direction and control of a foreign government, namely Russia. And then they charged me, also, the three of us, Penny Hess, Jesse Neville, and I, with being, with conspiracy to work for a foreign government without registering with the Department of Justice, which was an extraordinary charge. And so after a week-long trial or so, The jury examined things that came from more than 2.5 million books in equivalency, 13 terabytes of information that they stole from our devices. A jury determined that we were not Russian agents, and which meant, of course, that they agreed that the only thing we'd ever done is work for the liberation of African people, on the one hand. On the other hand, they convicted us of conspiracy to do something that never happened. And the Russian agent charge carried with it a 10-year prison sentence. And the conspiracy charge carries us, the conviction carries the possibility of a 5-year prison sentence and $250,000 fine. So on December 16th, we'll be going to Tampa, Florida, and we want everybody to come with us to face sentencing for, as they said, conspiring to do something that never happened.
You've long been known as an anti-war activist from Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. In this case, they said that your activism against the U.S. being involved with Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine was working on behalf of Russia. Can you respond?
Yeah, that's it's a ridiculous assumption. The fact is, our party has against every notorious war that the United States government has been involved in. We concluded a long time ago the inability of the United States to engage in a just war. And we were opposed to what they were doing in Vietnam, the United States did in Vietnam. We were opposed to the aggression against Cuba, the aggression against peoples all around the world. And this notion that somehow the Russians had to tell us to be opposed to what's happening in Ukraine is ridiculous for a number of reasons. And one of them being that, generally speaking, the Black Liberation Movement in this country has historically been opposed to those wars. And that's been a strategic problem for the United States, that even Foreign Affairs, one of the journals of the leading thinking representatives of the ruling class in this country, has complained about affecting in a negative way U.S. foreign policy because Black people have always been opposed to these wars. And that was true of us, too. So the notion that somehow the Russians had to teach us to do this is ridiculous. And I also think it's important to say that we believe in free speech in a very serious way. That this was an assault on freedom of speech, the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, and that Black people in this country have been in the vanguard of the struggle for the Bill of Rights, for free speech. And that's been absolutely necessary, because when the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights, was ratified by the United States Congress in 1791, Black people were property. We had no rights to speak or do anything like that. So who else would fight harder for the right to free speech, the right for freedom of assembly, the Bill of Rights, than Black people? And we've been in the vanguard, and so there's nothing that is new about that. And this assault that they're making on the Uhuru movement, the African People's Socialist Party, is actually an assault on African people, our agency, our right to have freedom of thought, to convict us of thinking something that, and what they say we think is up to their interpretation. So we didn't do anything, and that was the foundational charge. The jury said they didn't work for Russia, but they conspired to do something that never happened. So it's a thought crime that they have convicted us for, and we have fought it all along, and we continue to fight that.
So talk about your years of activism. When we last spoke, you said you have attended other international conferences, for example, in Spain, where your expenses were paid by a Spanish NGO. And explain the comparison you made with going to a conference in Russia, and talk about the issues you've raised.
Well, in the indictment, or certainly the press release around the indictment, the United States government declared that we took this expense-paid trip to Moscow. And they made it sound as if somehow there was some lavish occurrence that was paid for by Moscow, when the truth is, it was simple that they paid for our travel, to go to Moscow. They paid for housing while we were in Moscow. And when I say they, I'm talking about a non-governmental organization in Moscow paid for that and to attend conferences, international conferences, one of which had to do with a situation of nations of people who were struggling for liberation, for self-determination. And that was in 2015. I took two trips to Moscow. And then, you know, they overlooked the fact that I went to Spain in 2017, a non-governmental organization. They paid our transportation. They paid for three of us to come. They paid a hefty honorarium for my being there. And it was an international conference with people from all around the world. It was had participation from former members of the United Nations and from the Spanish government itself. But that didn't matter. They wanted to take this Moscow thing and act like it was something peculiar. I've traveled to more than 15, 16, 19 different countries, if I'm not mistaken, throughout the world, and as well as to Big Mountain, where the Diné or Navajo people were under assault. And I've done this partially because it's my responsibility to do it, to end the isolation that had occurred of our movement. We were attacked in the 1960s, and we were alone, the African Liberation Movement. We were isolated. And I wanted to make sure that didn't happen again. I wanted to win as many people around the world to recognize what our struggle is all about and to have friends for our movement. And so that's part of what this was about. Another aspect of it was showing solidarity to other peoples who were oppressed, the indigenous people. And even as we have this discussion now, it happens with the recognition that Leonard Peltier, an indigenous man, has been locked up for nearly 50 years for trying to defend the indigenous people. And you know, he's a political prisoner. So we've been doing this kind of work, and the U.S. government very selectively determined that the trip to Moscow, the connection to a Russian non-governmental organization represented working in the direction and control of a foreign government without notifying the United States government, Department of Justice, that I was doing, Attorney General, that I was working for a foreign agent, which is a ridiculous claim.
Al-Mali, talk about how the African People's Socialist Organization got started, how the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru Movement, got started.
Well, yeah, the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party, we stem from the whole struggle for civil rights in the United States. I myself had been an active working for voter education registration in the 1960s. I traveled throughout the state of Florida doing that. And I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And SNCC was that bridge between the anti-racist movement for integration and the Black Power anti-colonial movement. And SNCC introduced the whole issue of Black Power to the world. And I was a member of SNCC. And SNCC came under vicious assault, partially because of the Black Power demand. And people were jailed, were arrested, came under attack, and what have you. You may remember at the time Stokely Carmichael, as he was known, married Miriam Makeba, who was an extraordinary, internationally known artist.
Miriam Makeba, the great South African singer. That's Amale Yeshitela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and leader of the Uhuru Movement. He's 83 years old. He's due to be sentenced on Monday after a Florida jury found him and his co-defendants, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, known as the Uhuru Three, guilty of conspiring to act as Russian agents, but cleared them of actually doing so. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, What will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.